Hello. Welcome to Debrief, a King's Chambers podcast. My name is Nigel Poole. The Debrief podcast aims to provide an analysis of issues in the field of clinical negligence and healthcare law, and we hope that it will be of use and interest to lawyers and non-lawyers alike. In this episode, we're going to discuss mesothelioma and immunotherapy treatment, and how those litigating injury claims can respond to fast-developing medical developments. I'm delighted to be joined by Michael Rawlinson QC and Jeremy Rusak from King's Chambers. Mike is a leading QC in the field of industrial disease. He's been involved in many of the leading cases in that area, including Fairchild and the pleural plaques litigation. But he's also very experienced in other fields of personal injury work. He's been a QC since 2009, having been appointed at an obscenely young age. Jeremy specializes in personal injury and clinical negligence work. He qualified as a doctor in 1983 and worked in hospital medicine for more than 10 years before being called to the bar. He underwent training in general surgery and then specialised in surgery of the heart and chest. Now, Jeremy, with that background, Mike and I will gladly give you the floor to explain in the first place, please, what is the immune system?
That's very kind of you, Nigel. Thank you. The immune system is a phenomenally complex system. But fundamentally, what lies at its heart is the distinction between self and not self. So it has the ability to recognize invasive proteins, often on the surface of bacteria or viruses, recognize them as not self, and destroy them. It recognizes the invasive proteins, they're called antigens, by their shape. Proteins fold in a particular way. And it creates, in response to those antigens, antibodies. These are very large Y-shaped molecules, and on the tips of the Ys are locks into which the key of the antigen fits. And once it's latched on to the antigen, it then can either destroy it itself, or it can render it liable to be ingested and dealt with by other parts of the immune system, particularly white cells. Particularly interesting feature of the immune system is that it can be a little slow to respond on first exposure to a particular antigen, but remembers the antigens to which it's been exposed and can respond much more rapidly afterwards. And that explains why there are so many of the childhood diseases in particular that one only gets once. The response is very rapid. You don't get them again.
So, Mike, perhaps you can tell us what is mesothelioma?
Yes, Nigel, certainly. So it's a slightly unusual cancer in that it's a cancer of the linings of the chest cavity and the abdominal cavity. It's not a ball cancer. It's associated principally with exposure to asbestos, usually decades before, where indeed some external factor for its causation is being alleged at all. In theory, some mesotheliomas are said to be, quote, naturally occurring, close quotes, particularly in the case of women, where there is one paper that suggested one third of all cases were idiopathic. But given that the cancer is one that can be caused by very low doses of exposure to asbestos, there is no real way in practice of differentiating between, on the one hand, what is truly an idiopathic mesothelioma that was spontaneous, not caused by anything, and on the other hand, a mesothelioma arising out of a low and unrecorded exposure. There are subtypes of mesothelioma. Epitheloid is said to grow more slowly than sarcomatoid. And indeed, there are some variants that are said to be local, quote-unquote, mesotheliomas that are amenable to surgery, and their connection with asbestos is a much more tenuous. Invariably fatal. Unfortunately, death is preceded by increasing debility. Very often, 100% debility is reached reasonably quickly. It's associated with pain. It can be an aggressive cancer to the extent that a biopsy needle entry site can be an exit path for mesothelioma, breaking ribs open as it emerges. Incidence is still rising. There are about 2,000 cases, between 2,500 cases a year. It is said that we are reaching the zenith, but then it was said we were reaching the zenith when I started doing this sort of work in 1999. but we are clearly somewhere near the top because the increase is slowing. But it's going to plague us for decades to come. It takes 40, 50, 60 years to emerge. There are people today being exposed as chippies and sparkies on site who will unfortunately come to the attention of our successors in remote posterity. And as Jeremy reminded me before we started, we're exporting the problem because a lot of our old ships that are being sent out for breaking in Bangladesh and India and Pakistan are full of asbestos to a huge degree, and local workers there are getting their dose that will unfortunately see a lot of them in the grave.
Hmm. So you've said it's invariably fatal, but are there some treatment options for mesothelioma?
It's one of those diseases which are very difficult for doctors to deal with because there is no really effective treatment for it. Surgery, apart from the one or two minor and rare instances that Mike mentioned earlier, is pretty much useless. Chemotherapy is proving promising. It's quite nasty chemotherapy. It's aggressive. It has significant side effects. But it can result in a diminution in size of the tumour, which can last, once the course is finished, for some months sometimes. Rechallenge with further courses if the tumour then starts to advance can generally be done once. Immunotherapy has come increasingly to the fore. Immunotherapy is composed of antibodies. They're called monoclonal antibodies because they're produced in large quantities by various technological means. And when I come to mention one or two of the names of the drugs, you'll notice they all end in MAB, which is an abbreviation for monoclonal antibody. The use of immunotherapy can come at various stages in the course of treatment. So there is excellent evidence from well-conducted studies that one particular form of immunotherapy, a drug called Avastin or bevacizumab, can be very effective if given with the initial course of chemotherapy. And that poses some difficulties for lawyers because frequently we don't become involved until after that first course of chemotherapy has been given, or we can't find a suitable defendant until that time. And bevacizumab for this purpose is not licensed by NICE, and we'll come back to the reasons for that a bit later. So it has to be paid for privately. Other drugs, pembrolizumab is quite widely used now. It's used in other forms of cancer, some forms of lung cancer, and in particular malignant melanoma. And there are others called nivolumab or ipilimumab, which are proving quite promising. But it needs to be borne in mind that all of these drugs serve only to delay the progression of the disease. Some can lead to a degree of resolution, but for the most part, they're holding therapies. They're palliative therapies. One of the issues with access is that mesothelioma, although, as Mike says, 2,500 new cases a year in the UK, is a relatively rare tumour. Trials that have been done tend to be very small, and the effect of the drug isn't, in most cases, dramatic. And so it's very difficult to prove to the satisfaction of NICE, which of course, perfectly reasonably, has the duty of balancing cost and benefit, that these very expensive treatments, upwards of £100,000 for a year's treatment, are actually cost effective. And so generally, they can be obtained only privately. We'll talk about exactly how they can be obtained privately a little bit later. And one of the difficulties that arises is that when one of these drugs is used and obtained privately, in general, all the other drugs that are being used for treatment must be obtained privately as well. So if somebody, for example, is going to have Avastin with their initial course of chemotherapy, they need to pay not only for the Avastin, but also for the chemotherapy.
I think also, just to dive in there, if I may, for a second, the trouble with this condition is not the severity necessarily on its own for the individual victim, but because the victims are multiple. Two particular examples. The first is that there are those who are clearly susceptible and who succumb in early middle age. Distressingly, I know of one case where the victim is 19, but somebody who is 40, 45 with 25, 30 years of earnings ahead of them, may have two or three kids, has a dependent partner. These are claims where the family is just simply robbed of their loved one and main earner for decades to come. The other extreme is with an aging population, more and more of our clients now who succumb to this disease are at the time that they become ill, the main carer for partners who are themselves highly physically dependent or may have mental disabilities. And in those circumstances, you lose the victim. They lose the relationship between themselves. The remaining spouse loses the principal carer. And society loses out because outside of compensation to try and steady the ship, these are people who are then, the survivors that is, are going into homes or sheltered accommodation, whereas otherwise they would have maintained perfectly happy lives in the community being cared for by the person who has succumbed to mesothelioma. So the ripples in the pond here do spread out quite widely on occasions.
So thinking of immunotherapy, can you give me an idea? Five years ago, were these treatments available for mesothelioma, or is it?
No, is the short answer to that. These came to the fore probably about 2 years ago, and suffused in all of this has been the attempts on both sides of the litigation fence to try to come to terms with a situation that is both fast-moving, because the oncologist will tell you that there are revolutions once every 3 or 6 months. Where the evidence, as Jeremy has said already, and we'll return to this, is thin because there are no long-term studies. They're just not capable of being carried out given the nature of the condition. And where, again, as we'll come to in a short while, there are peculiarities about the interface between immunotherapy as a remedy capable of being granted by way of compensation via the court and sorting out cases sooner rather than later. Mm. So this is an area where both sides have really had to grapple very quickly with a massively changing situation. I suppose if you summed it up in a sentence, the position we now find ourselves in, those who act for claimants, is to try via compensation to keep the client long enough alive to benefit from the next step in the revolution. And it's happening. We are seeing cases where people are living substantially longer than otherwise would have been the case without immunotherapy.
So in this sort of fast-developing area of treatment, how do you manage that as a litigator? You know, what are the general legal challenges that you face?
I think the first is keeping in the swim. So you need to have a sense of what is going on with the medical profession. And of course, PubMed is a great source for that. Talking to other lawyers, it's amazing how often you'll pick something up when somebody's talking to you and they'll assume you know about it. And of course, the lawyer's trick is then to look sagacious and not let on that you had no idea before.
Is that what you do?
Also looking at the trade publications, sort of JPIL, articles in JPIL can be very useful. But it is a challenge and it's something that you positively have to find time for, because otherwise you will fall behind and then we have the nightmare of the risk that you didn't investigate an area. And it's always subject to the experts, of course, that might have made a difference.
And you talked about the difficulty of being able to establish a sort of cost-benefit analysis. So many of these treatments are not approved, maybe all of them, none of them are approved by NICE. Do you have to establish some evidence base for the treatment before you can claim compensation for the cost of it, if that's what you're
doing? We have to establish that it is likely to be of some beneficial effect. And there are, although small, sufficient trials to give an indication that some of these drugs will either cause an advancing tumour in a patient who's already had one or two courses of chemotherapy to regress, or at the very least to hold it. And when I said earlier that the treatment is merely palliative, I mean, of course, that it is not curative. It doesn't intend a cure. That's not to say that it can't help to keep people alive for significant periods of time. And as we'll come to in a moment, the quality of life of somebody who is being treated with immunotherapy can be really very high. And so not only is it keeping people alive, it's keeping people alive and able to enjoy the life they're getting.
Mm. Well, I think two lawyers, three opinions. Jeremy said that you have to show that it's likely to be of some benefit. I know he didn't mean on the balance of probabilities, but I'm afraid I take a much more hardline view than that. It seems to me that given the alternative is inexorable and inevitable death, there needs to be little more than advice provided from a reputable source that this is something sensible to try. And as JBR and I both know, because we both cite this case regularly and often, there is the case of Najib, where Mrs. Justice Nicola Davis, as she then was presented with the facts in these circumstances that a man with mesothelioma had frankly been given some unjustifiable advice that if he just took a drug, it would render the mesothelioma reactive to light. And that if he had lasers shone at his chest, the cancer would burst. And the claimant's own very reputable chest physician at trial readily conceded that this was, I think to use his rather understated phrase, unconventional or lacking in evidence of efficacy. But the point was put by claimant's counsels, Harry Steinberg, I think, from recollection, that it was reasonable in the circumstances. And the judge agreed. Hmm. And when you look at the deep roots of how these claims are made, and they are made against the standard test of, is it reasonable to try? There is always going to be thrown into that metric on one side of the balance, what's the alternative? And these are people who are trapped into a disease and death process, which they didn't choose, obviously. Most of whom deal with it stoically. A lot of whom refuse treatment. I have quite a few clients who, when they're offered chemotherapy, will say, no, it's just not worth it for reasons that Jeremy will come on to in a short while. But many will say, is there a potential magic pill? And if so, let's take it. But I think we're sort of drifting towards the legal challenges that we face in these circumstances that may be worth just rehearsing.
I think perhaps one thing that's worth saying about Najib, of course, is that it was treatment that he'd already had in the past. It wasn't the court being asked to sanction treatment he was going to have in the future. He'd already had it and paid for it. And so the question was it reasonable in the circumstances for him to have done that? Yeah. And it may well be that the bar is set a little bit lower in those circumstances than sanctioning treatment to be taken place in the future.
That is entirely fair. It should not make a difference, but I completely accept that in reality it will. Whether that means that we place a premium on hasty poor decision making as opposed to rather more languorous poor decision making, I don't know, but I accept the reality of what you say there completely.
Before we get on to the sort of procedures or mechanisms that you might deploy in these cases, can I just ask about access to the sort of treatment we're talking about? If it hasn't been through the NICE approval process, is it available on the NHS, or is it only available through trials, or what's the answer to that?
It's not available on the NHS. And even, although the British Thoracic Society, in its review of the treatment of mesothelioma, commented on the excellent level of evidence that bevacizumab in particular, given with first-line chemotherapy, is a beneficial effect, even then that drug is not available on the NHS. And so really, the only way in which access can be gained to these drugs is by that subset of mesothelioma victims who can identify a defendant, who can obtain, while it is still useful, a judgment against that defendant, who can identify an insurer who will then be able to satisfy that judgment, and then the money can start flowing and it can be used to pay for what I commented earlier, these very expensive drugs. That obviously creates some ethical challenges for legal practitioners in the field. We are lawyers, we are not doctors. My dim and distant past I was, but I don't practice anymore. And so we have the questions, is it appropriate for us to suggest to clients that they might consider these treatments? Well, I think we can probably all agree that is entirely appropriate. They do exist. And generally, in fact, they will have been mentioned to them by their treating clinicians. Most of them, by the time they come to be considered for immunotherapy, will, as I've said, have had one or possibly two courses of chemotherapy, and they'll therefore be very familiar with the generally fairly significant side effects and trauma of undergoing courses of this complex and advanced and aggressive chemotherapy. And provided that access to funding can be found and is available, they can be told that immunotherapy, well, it also is not without side effects. No effective drug is. Those side effects tend to be less severe and tend to resolve when the drug is withdrawn reasonably quickly. The other point, as I think Mike mentioned earlier, is that by the time they have had one or two courses of chemotherapy and the tumour is again advancing, there is nothing else. Mm. And if there is nothing else, then provided it's not actively harmful, the threshold for recommending and advising that this treatment at least be considered and tried is pretty low. The next dilemma that arises is the trial dilemma. And I think Mike has something to say about that.
Yeah, this is something that we grapple with, and it's not easy. As JBR says, we're not drug salesmen. We're not here to induce somebody to take drugs that otherwise they wouldn't have done. But the trial dilemma arises in this way. There are very eminent chest physicians who are concerned about the effect of lawyers' involvement in this area, because what they say, and from their perspective perfectly reasonably, is this: for each client that you obtain private provision in respect of, that is a loss to the data collection processes that the NHS would like to undertake, so that in future NICE might have a sufficient evidential basis to recommend that immunotherapy be provided for mesothelioma. That point is unarguably correct. However, it is met by a point of equal power from the lawyers. And the lawyer's point is this: yes, but we owe a duty to our clients. That duty extends to advise. And if we are asked the question first, can you get me compensation for the potential wonder drug? My answer is almost certainly yes. No such thing as guarantee in litigation, but we're not far from it. Second question: if I undergo the trial, might I be given placebo? Answer: depends on the trial. There are some trials where they're simply open label, everybody knows what they're getting. There are some trials where there are the choices between best palliative care, and it doesn't mean ignoring the client, it means giving them the best palliative care on the one hand, or the immunotherapy being investigated on the other. And so there will be some trials where the client is at risk of getting what we might call, not demeaningly, but just by way of shorthand, the sugar pill, the placebo. And my experience is that most clients say to me, if you can get me the compensation for it, and if there is a prospect that it might lengthen my life, do it. And so you have this immovable object and an irresistible force. Both sides are right. The difficulty is that I owe no duty to the NHS or wider society. I owe a duty to my client, and I'm afraid that's the perspective I have to take. Now, it may well be the case that this dilemma eases slightly, because as I understand it, the British Lung Foundation, which pulls in funding from various sources, including, it's right to say this, including the insurers themselves, that they are putting money into this, are devising trials where the choices are between various types of immunotherapy. And so that ameliorates the dilemma to a degree. But it is one that troubles me. And it is one that I think you can only really get to grips by actually talking to the client about. And I do have some clients, not many, but I do have some who say, nope, I've got a duty to society, I will take my place in the trial if it's available. And of course, as Jeremy said beforehand, trials aren't always available. They are geographically limited. They've got all sorts of entry criteria, not least, for example, and JBR and I have had this in a case specifically, where there is present another cancer. So it's not right for everybody, the trial, but there we are. And I think that leads on to the last area of ethics that we were thinking about beforehand.
And that's the involvement of the defendant's expert oncologist. Now, on the claimant's side, we have the oncologist, the chest physician, who is treating the mesothelioma, who's administering the drugs, who's taking the day-to-day treatment decisions. And we also have the medico-legal expert, who will give the court advice about the wisdom and the availability of certain types of treatment. On the defendant's side, of course, there is no clinician. There is the expert advising oncologist. And once funding is available and earmarked for treating a patient with immunotherapy and that treatment has been embarked upon, the issue arises of whether the defendant's medico-legal expert can or should have any input into the way in which that treatment is conducted, how long it persists for, whether it should be discontinued, whether it should be restarted if it has been discontinued.
Yeah.
And the view that has been generally expressed with most of the experts that I've spoken to on either side has been that for an oncologist to interfere in the doctor-patient relationship merely because he's instructed by a client who is effectively approaching the issue with only one aim, which is to avoid paying for the treatment, is probably unethical. And most of those who've been approached, I think, have declined to become involved.
Aside from that difficulty or that role from a defendant's perspective, I suppose it must be obvious that in all the cases where you're seeking some payment for treatment, you have an admission of liability, or you have judgment, because otherwise you can't begin to do that. But tell me, Mike, something more about how you go about managing these claims, because there must be all sorts of procedural as well as quantification issues that you encounter.
Yeah, yes, well, there certainly are. And the point, Nigel, if I may say, that you raised at the end is a good one. This system can really only thrive because the mesothelioma specialist list has the show cause procedure. So I think unique to this area of litigation, a defendant must show, it's not a very high hurdle, but they must show that they have the right to defend on breach. Because in most cases, without that sort of nudge, what happens is that defendants put in effectively non-admission defences, and it's left to the claimants to prove via their own recollection exposure, which really was always going to be proven, but it delays matters. But the system in the mesothelioma list is that right from the word go, there is this show cause procedure. And it does become an absolutely critical hurdle within the life of the litigation. Because as you rightly say, in the absence of public provision, unless there is a sufficiently high chance that you're going to win at trial so that you can make your application under the ordinary procedure for an interim payment, of which more later, really you need to show cause. So that's the first of the hurdle. Assuming that to be the case, that you've either got judgment or judgment has been entered by consent, the rest of the challenges really in this area stem from the fact that you are trying to settle the claim as quickly as you can. Because joyful as it is to meet Jeremy, most people want to have lawyers out of their hair as fast as they possibly can, and rightly so. Better things to be doing with their time. So the difficulty that you have is that the therapy usually hasn't actually commenced at the time that you're trying to settle the case. Well, so what? There are plenty of PI cases where future expenditure is contingent, unknown, etc. And the answer is yes, there are, but not with this stark degree of, on the one hand, cost. So some of these immunotherapy combinations are up to £250,000 a year in cost, with extreme uncertainty as to either A, whether you're going to use them at all, B, if you do use them, are you going to continue using them? Some are not efficacious, some are positively harmful, and it's something that the client must understand, that if immunotherapy goes wrong, it usually means that there's an organ packing up somewhere. It's quite significant stuff. And three, whether you will stay on the same therapy for any length of time or move on to another therapy. And if it is another therapy, what price that will be per annum. And this harks back to what I said earlier about the rolling revolution. because the oncologists are the equivalent of kids in the sweet shop, they are taking all sorts of combinations of these drugs in parallel and in series to see what works. Because this is, I'm afraid, a giant lab experiment. So what you can't do is what you ordinarily would seek to do, which is simply multiply the total cost by the likelihood of its incurrence, because the issues here are too significant. And I've had two masters now, and I think one judge sitting Section 9, all of whom have expressed their disquiet that that would be a sensible way of disposing of this head of loss. So what you can't do is get rid of this by a lump sum, because what happens is, let's say that we gave 50,000 to everybody, and you could, as an actuarial exercise, divide the total cost spend on immunotherapy in any insurer's past financial year by the number of claims made and dole it out.
As an average.
As an average. Yeah. And I hardly need to continue to show the absurdity of that. Probably on the statistics, 8 out of 10 are significantly overcompensated. 2 out of 10 would be undercompensated, of whom 1/2 would be seriously undercompensated. And of course, because these therapies are cyclical, they are effectively fighting a rising tide. They need to be given with very clear periodicity. Once the drugs stop, the sea overcomes the defences and the disease continues. So that simply is not a way to deal with it. The next probably most significant problem is that the palette of orders available to the court and imposable by the court without consent is really very limited. It is the lump sum in damages. It is the PPO, which is a frankly fractious fit. It doesn't really fit smoothly. We'll go back to that in a short while. Or it is to adjourn off this issue and to clog up the list forevermore with applications for interim payments.
So in theory, you could seek an interim payment each time you needed the next round of treatment and you knew it was going to occur. But as you say, how many would you have to make in a year?
Well, precisely. And this is a list, the mesothelioma list, which has gaps in it in order to accommodate the incredibly urgent. And for the same reason that, for instance, there are no CCMCs, no cost case management case applications in the meso list, because it would clog up the list. To have the list populated with yet another trip for another £30,000, £40,000, £50,000 isn't helpful. And of course, the other difficulty, just to warm to my theme, is this, that what you can't do is go to court and say, can I have £250,000, please? Because that assumes that the client will receive that level of immunotherapy for a year or 2 years. Well, I can't show my client's going to be alive in a year or 2 years, so I fail the test of showing that I would be entitled to these damages at trial, because retrospectively, if the client dies the week after the application, I couldn't. So it has to be a series of short-term steps. Now, where, and this moves on to moving off the pallet, where we move to consensual approaches, and this is something JBR is going to talk about in a moment, very often what you have to say to a defendant is this: we would like to reach agreement with you, but if we can't, then the default position is the interim payment, and that is as difficult and unpleasant for you guys as it is for us and the list generally. So please meet us in the middle and try and settle. Well, that's it from my perspective. I'm sure the defendants will see it very differently, but from my perspective, that's how we approach these things. So those are the difficulties, which has led to what can only be described as a fairly innovative approach having to be adopted across the span of cases, with each practitioner fairly clearly having their own preference as they go along.
So what sort of bespoke solutions have been arrived at, Jeremy?
Well, as Mike has said, the lump sum solution simply doesn't wash. It doesn't work. The therapy is going to go on for an unknown period of time. Well, that of itself isn't a problem. That's what periodical payments orders are for. But it may not yet have started. It may never start. If it does start, it may stop and restart before eventually it stops completely. And of course, it may vary considerably in cost if different regimes are chosen. So fundamentally, the periodical payments order, while there are ways of making it work, and it can be bent and contorted into a way that does make it work, is not terribly appropriate, particularly in cases where the treatment hasn't yet started. What the defendants say to that is, fine, we will offer you an indemnity. We will say that we will pay your private provider for the costs of these drugs, either directly, if you send us the invoices, or by reimbursing you. And we will also pay for other additional expenses. And it has seemed to us that, firstly, that's an unsound legal basis for settling a case, because we receive damages by way of money, not by way of barter. And there is nothing to say that a claimant must have put himself to an expense in order to be recompensed. Importantly, there may be differences in the payment terms between the insurers and the providers. With the best will in the world, mistakes happen. The providers can find themselves unpaid, particularly those who require payment in advance for these expensive drugs. And the one thing that we do know is that potential interruption in the treatment, once it's been embarked upon, can be extremely damaging, potentially catastrophic. And so any claimant who enters into this kind of an agreement must, I think, be advised to set aside a lump sum, £20,000, £30,000 perhaps, of the damages which he, and it's usually a he, has been awarded under other heads of loss to cover the gaps and the shortfalls. And that, again, seems to us to be fundamentally wrong. And so we have devised a couple of other routes by which payment can be made more secure. The first was in a case called Scott, in which Mike and I were involved nearly 2 years ago now. He had a mesothelioma. He'd had two courses of chemotherapy. Both had been effective, but transiently effective. He'd heard of immunotherapy, was very keen to have it. And the agreement which eventually we obtained from the defendants was quite far-reaching. It essentially provided that he was entitled to have pretty much any form of private therapy recommended by a reputable oncologist, and the only way the defendants could challenge it was by challenging our arithmetic in working out the cost. That hasn't proved enormously popular with defendants, it's fair to say. But the agreement that we have subsequently designed, and it's been through, I think, 8 iterations now, we refer to as a trust float agreement. So a trust fund is set up. It can be managed either by the claimant's existing solicitors or by any other firm. A lump sum is paid into that trust, equating to something like a quarter's cost of the immunotherapy. The trustees meet the bills as and when they're required. And periodically, either every time they make a payment or once a month, they let the defendant's insurers know how much they've spent, and the defendant's insurer tops up the float. Security of payment is guaranteed, security of continued treatment is guaranteed, and a term of the trust is that upon permanent cessation of treatment, or sadly, as inevitably happens, the death of the claimant, any money which has not been spent on immunotherapy, and the money in the trust is devoted to immunotherapy, is repaid to the defendants. And it seems to us that that is absolutely fair. It provides for a defendant tortfeasor, his insurer, to pay for all that treatment arising out of his tort, but not for any more. There is no risk of overpayment because the money was given back as soon as the treatment finishes, and there's no risk of underpayment because the fund is available. Not all defendants are prepared to enter into those agreements, and certainly they cannot be ordered because by their nature they're far too variable. And so we come then to the last fallback, which, as Mike mentioned earlier, is the repeated interim payments. And we have an order which has been approved by, I think, two of the asbestos masters now to date, which provides for all the claimant's damages, save for the cost of future immunotherapy, to be paid by way of an interim payment. And it has to be expressed as an interim payment. It's not a final order. If immunotherapy has already started, there is in addition the first interim payment to cover the costs of the first quarter. And thereafter, further interim payment applications are listed on a regular basis. That would work, we think, very well, although at cost and at inconvenience, in the mesothelioma list in London. it's less clear that it would work quite as well because of listing constraints in any of the regional mesothelioma lists.
It's true. And to pick up on Jeremy's points, with an adjournment for the interim payment, the original solicitor's ATE remains in place, so they're on uplift and full time. With the trust float, there's very little need for the solicitor to be involved ever again beyond a simple liberty to apply, and the costs are fixed. The other thing about the trust float is that, as drafted, they are fairly complex agreements, because the one thing you want to remove is uncertainty and the chance for delay. So, for instance, we define in a series of steps what reasonable treatment is ahead of time, so that we know either A, this will be agreed because it's deemed agreed beforehand, or B, there is a mechanism in place for very swift resolution so that nothing gets in the way of the timely and compensated for provision of treatment. The vast majority of the defendants that we are against are doing what we are doing, trying to come to a solution bona fide from their own perspective. Long may that be so. There is one clause that I sometimes see and insisted upon that makes me wonder at how it might ever be reasonably supposed that a claimant would agree to this. And it's this. Some of the indemnity agreements have within them a clause that says, if you undertake this expenditure, and if we challenge it, and if, however unlikely this may be, the court were to hold, in the light of Najib, that to have been an unreasonable course to take, we want our money back. Now, the reason why that makes me slightly hot under the collar is that I've had three, from recollection, clients who have asked me the question in those circumstances, can you guarantee to me that the clawback will not occur? And I've said to them again, there are no guarantees in litigation. I am highly confident that the clawback will not occur. No, you're not listening to me. Can you guarantee it? No, I can't guarantee it. Right. So I might incur hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of costs. Unlikely, say I. All right, tens of thousands of pounds. Yeah, more likely. And there might be a chance that it had to be repaid. Yes. And that might come from my other damages set aside for my family. Well, how you dispose of damages is a matter for you, but the answer to that may be yes. Right, well, I'm not undertaking the treatment. Mm. And the chilling effect it has is one that I, frankly, am not prepared to abide unless I get strict instructions to the contrary. My advice always in those circumstances be don't do it. Because that is the other reason why the multiple interim payments is the issue of last resort, because there it's always prospective. If the defendants want to come along and argue that drug X is not reasonable, well, let's have the argument there and then, whilst I'm seeking my interim for the next 3 months hence. But the clawback is, I'm struggling to find a word that's not pernicious, but it is at least very unfortunate in its effect.
I think that's right. I mean, these agreements are reached by negotiation. Although we have drafts that we tend to use, any clause in it can potentially be tweaked by any defendant who wishes to alter it slightly. But I agree entirely with Mike that that particular clause that deals with any recoupment of monies advanced and spent in good faith is an absolute red line, and one that I would never advise a client to agree.
What's interesting to hear is that the basis of compensation is that neither party wants the claim to be overcompensated or undercompensated, really, if you're indeed applying a just solution to it. And in a field where there is this fast-moving, fast-developing new treatments available, but with all the uncertainties that you described associated with that, the usual models of compensation don't really work terribly well. But it's taken the litigators to work with each other, and no doubt with considerable imagination on your part, but to develop a system that can achieve a fair result. I wonder whether it can be applied in other areas. I mean, mesothelioma, you think automatically in clinical negligence of delay in diagnosing cancer cases, for example, but Do you think this model is applicable potentially in other areas?
Potentially, yes. And I know JB, I'll say something about that in a moment. I think my only comment would be this, that the one blessing that we have in this area of litigation is that there are so few people on both sides of the litigation fence at the bar doing this. It's probably a dozen each side, that everybody knows each other well, knows each other's style, knows broadly the views that they take on these sorts of things. And information disseminates sideways very quickly. And so these, whether one accepts that it should be an indemnity agreement, and there are some barristers on the claimant side who think that that is the way forward. I wouldn't criticise them for that at all. That is their view, reach bona fide. Mine is slightly different, but it's we know what those they are. We can move forward within that sort of series of parameters. Whether you could do that where, for instance, you've got delayed diagnosis in clinical negligence, where the cadre of barristers specialising in this is much wider, I don't know. Perhaps I'm reading too much into practice that doesn't get into judgments, but it strikes me that there is something very interesting, unique about mesothelioma litigation.
But there are obvious differences, and yep. you've talked about the show cause procedure. Liability is often much more difficult to establish, and there's a much greater reluctance to make admissions in clinical negligence delay in diagnosing cancer. By definition, the patient had cancer in the first place and there was a delay in diagnosing it. So you're comparing one treatment modality with another, as it were. So there are obvious differences. But Jeremy, you think that this model might be a way?
Absolutely. I don't really see any reason why not. I've certainly used the practice direction 3D, the show cause procedure, by analogy. When I've had a client with a different type of cancer that's well advanced, whose life expectancy is therefore very short, there are the practical difficulties that Mike's just alluded to. The mesothelioma system is well set up and generally, certainly in London, works extremely smoothly. But nothing that we have said today about mesothelioma really is completely inapplicable, either to a cancer which has advanced to an extent that the normal modalities of treatment are not either available or likely to be effective, and therefore new modalities need to be thought about. Or indeed, of course, those cancers which might be caused by, as mesothelioma is, exposure to noxious substances at work.
Well, thank you both. That's all for this episode of Debrief. My thanks very much to Mike Rawlinson and to Jeremy Rusak. There'll be a fact sheet to accompany this episode, which will be available by email from podcasts@kingschambers.com. And you can listen to all our podcasts by going to the resources and training section of the King's Chambers website, kingschambers.com, or you can use your favoured platform. Thank you again to Mike and Jeremy, and goodbye.